Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I want to say one word to you people, just one word. Are you listening? No, it's not plastics, it's mobile. All you got to do is figure out the ads, but believe you me, that's harder than it sounds. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 22nd of October. It's a Monday. Good to have you with us. You want to make it in the digital world today, gang. There is just one thing you have to do. Figure out how to make money on mobile ads. That's it. No big deal. I mean, sure, Google hasn't figured it out. That's why its profits were down last week. Facebook reports earnings tomorrow. Same problem. Advertisers just don't want to pay as much for those teeny tiny ads on those teeny tiny phone screens. Turns out we consumers don't pay much attention to those teeny tiny ads anyway. Marketplace's Queen of Kim explains why mobile ads are such a mess.
It's being called the mobile curse. Joe Laszlo is a researcher at the Interactive Advertising Bureau.
The mobile curse is the sense that companies that are doing very well as PC-oriented digital media companies are having trouble making the transition to mobile.
Let's take Google. Here's how it makes most of its money. Type in flat-screen TV, and Google serves up a paid link where you can click and buy that TV. But getting consumers to do that on their mobile devices isn't going so well. Nate Wickman is a computer science student, and we caught up with him at New York's Grand Central Station.
I don't make large purchases with my cell phone because I feel like spending a large amount of money, I would like to do some more research online, which is easier on a real computer.
Other passersby complained that photos are hard to see, and if you click the wrong button, forget about it. Rebecca Lieb is an analyst at the Altimeter Group. She says the mobile curse doesn't stop there.
And the problem with mobile is when you're talking about mobile, you're talking about a whole bunch of things.
Facebook, for example, sells most of its ads on the very right column of its website. But that column doesn't exist on mobile. All you get on a smartphone is a news feed. So Facebook has been putting ads there.
And they've had great success at that so far. We're seeing click-through rates that are literally 10x.
Michael Pachter is a research analyst at Wedbush. The curse? There are only so many ads people will put up with in their news feeds. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
This is a big moment in the family history of Ancestry.com. The genealogy website is going to be taken over by a private equity group. The price tag is about $1.6 billion, which does kind of make you go, wow, that's a lot of money for a bunch of family trees. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has the logic behind the price point.
Ancestry.com has around 2 million subscribers. They pay as much as $35 a month for the chance to delve into the site's archives. Ancestry.com's been international for years, but now plans a major push into Europe.
There is some ripening of the market.
Elaine Collins is with BrightSolid, which owns family history websites all over the world. She says interest in Ancestry is on the rise in Europe as more people leave their home countries to find work elsewhere in the European Union.
The more migration and dislocation there is, it plays to this human instinct of wanting to understand our roots more.
Here in the U.S., Ancestry.com pretty much owns that market, but its stock has been sagging. Tech analyst Laura Didio says it can be hard for a company built on a steady revenue stream to excite investors.
Let's face it, it's not the same as being a Cisco or an Apple, where you were going to have a new product that comes out every 6 months.
Ancestry.com is getting into the DNA business and the software business, but its real expansion power lies in its brand, says Brad McCarty with trade publication The Next Web.
The secret sauce to their success is going to be business development deals.
AKA partnerships. Ancestry.com did have a TV show, Who Do You Think You Are? On NBC. It's been canceled, but the BBC version of the show is still going strong. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We are, at long last, in the electoral home stretch, 2 weeks and a day until Election Day. Most of you already know who you like, but some small but critical slice of people have no idea, which means for the next 15 days, both candidates are going to be trying really, really hard to get those undecided voters to make up their minds. Lynn Vavreck studies the undecideds at UCLA, where she's a professor of political science, so we got her on the phone to talk about this. Hey, Lynn, good to have you here.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So what do we know about these people? Who are they?
Well, right now, the first thing we know is that there aren't very many of them. But 60% of the undecided voters right now are women.
Why is it that 60% of undecideds are women? I mean, that just seems like a lot.
I hate to say this, and I apologize to my sisters out there,
okay.
But women are just, in general, a little less interested in politics, and they know a little less about the political world. So that gets amplified in this set of undecided voters.
Is it basically that life is busy, that they're trying to, you know, pay the mortgage and make sure the kids get to school on time and all of that stuff? I mean, is that why people aren't paying attention?
Yeah. This is now where I'm going to speculate a little, but they tend to have more children in their home than women who are decided. So part of the caricature that comes from the data for me is this single mom who has two or three kids. She's got to get them to school. She's got to make them dinner. And she doesn't have the luxury to sit down and listen to Marketplace.
I don't even know what to say about that. Is there something the campaigns can do? Is there an amount of money that they can spend on advertising, for instance, that's going to get these people to come around to their side in the next 16 days?
If I were telling them what I think the best strategy is to get the undecided voters, I would say advertising in the last 5 days before Election Day, that's when they're going to start paying attention, and it will be those last couple of days that are critical for swaying the undecideds.
Are they going to run I'm a great guy and my opponent is a stinker ads, or are they going to run pure negative ads? I mean, what works?
Well, if the past is any indication of what's coming, it'll likely be only the attack ads. They tend to get people's attention a little more. So when you're trying to get the attention of a group of people who aren't focused, probably vitriolic attack ads are more likely to grab their attention.
Lynn Vavreck is a professor of political science and communication studies at UCLA. She's the co-author of a book called The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 election. Lynn, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
If you're an undecided watching the debate tonight, or even if you've already made up your mind, you can follow it along with us. I'll be live tweeting the festivities as well. At Kai Rizdahl is how you find me on Twitter. On Wall Street today, not much to write home about, got to tell you. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. By this point in presidential campaigns, we've all usually heard quite a bit about the great state of Ohio, about its politics, its economic past, and its uncertain future. This, however, will be a story of a different stripe, because it's entirely possible that Ohio is on the cutting edge of the next big thing in the American economy. The Buckeye State sits on a piece of geology that holds a whole lot of oil. And love it or hate it, the technology that lets us get at that oil, fracking, has a lot of analysts wondering if America might be the world's next petrostate. So today we start an occasional series on the boom in North American oil and gas production, what it's going to mean for the American economy, our energy security, global politics, and the environment as well. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong gets us going in Carroll County out in eastern Ohio.
In the hills of Appalachia, Ohio, this is the sound of energy boom. They're drinking again at the Atwood Lake Resort. It closed down 2 years ago, but just reopened thanks to $2 million from energy company Sierra Buckeye. It paid for drilling rights under the lodge's 500 acres. You see, there's oil in them hills.
When you live out here, you don't have a lot of options to go out to eat. This is it.
Local retiree Janet Eady has come back for dinner 4 nights straight. She talks like this rural county of 30,000 people just won the oil lottery. Carroll County has the most active wells in the state.
There's a lot of people talking about it. There's a lot of people involved with it. It's an influx of money that I've never seen in this county before.
Oh, this is fantastic. It'll bring us out of medieval times.
At another bar sits retiree Glenn Gallagher. He says landowners can get tens of thousands of dollars from drilling companies.
People that like it is the people getting these huge checks for royalties. The people that don't have the ground are more or less jealous of them.
Rents here have quadrupled thanks to the influx of oil workers, or roughnecks, like a 30-something man named Denver one stool over. He's not allowed to give his last name or the pipeline company he works for.
Roughnecks, we got money, we spend money. Roughnecks don't have a pot to pee in. I don't know a roughneck out there that has a bank account. We have toys, motorcycles, four-wheelers, and houses, and trucks. That's what we do.
Welcome to Oil Boomtown, Ohio, where a beer costs $1.50, where the marching bands play Katy Perry, and where the t-shirts at the fall fair suggest that pie fixes everything. In fact, shale fixes everything. A formation called the Utica Shale sits 2 miles down. It's got a whole lot of natural gas, like Pennsylvania next door, but far more important, it's loaded with more profitable crude oil. Getting it out requires the controversial process called fracking. It all has some suggesting that America is the world's next great fossil fuel producer. Jack Girard is the oil industry's top man in Washington.
Look at Pennsylvania. Look at Ohio. All these are potential major energy producers. The United States could become the new Middle East.
The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that the Utica Shale contains nearly a billion barrels of oil. It would take 110,000 wells to get all the energy out. Wells and pump jacks aren't new to Carroll County. They found oil here in the Civil War. It's one reason a man named Rockefeller put refineries in Cleveland. But over the years, energy fortunes, whether it's oil or gas or coal, have swung up and down. Turns out, having a natural resource hasn't always turned out a blessing, warns Ohio State economist Mark Partridge.
One of the things about energy in particular that's always a little scary is the boom-bust cycle, what economists call the natural resources curse, that places with a lot of natural resources often underperform places without natural resources.
He cites economic underperformers like Louisiana and West Virginia. So how could a resource be a curse? Take the roads. It takes 1,000 water tanker trucks to frack one well. The local roads aren't strong enough, so the drillers are repaving them. But what if, over time, they chew them up again? Local activist Paul Fiesel.
Will they repave the road one more time before they leave? The proof will be 10, 20 years from now when the bottom feeders are here, whether or not those roads continue to get taken care of or not.
And when the trucks and the rigs move on, what happens to the workers? Will they be rich from the oil patch?
Would you like me to speak frankly?
Again, oil man Denver from the bar. He's a hiring manager, and he ends up giving a whole lot of jobs to guys from Texas and Oklahoma instead of Ohio.
Most of the people cannot pass a test around here. This drug test. So we have to outsource to a lot of people from out of the area.
Local business groups acknowledge the drug problem, but they argue that unemployment here has fallen sharply. And the questions keep coming. Will the farmland produce after it's poked and it's fracked? What about the water wells? Will high rents and labor costs turn away other businesses? Will Carroll County end up with more bars and fewer parks?
You know, we're not really sure how we prevent that.
County Commissioner Jeff Oler wonders if oil and gas become all the economic eggs in the basket here and make this county unattractive to other new businesses.
The only way we can prevent that is looking for opportunities to bring other types of industries in.
Back at the bar, you don't have much use or time for party poopers. Heck, the oil hangover may never come. They'd rather talk about that big energy executive from Oklahoma, who said not long ago that oil and gas are the biggest things to hit Ohio since the plow. In Carroll County, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, true or false, this is completely legal.
He would fire any employee who voted the wrong way.
True. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 2 points, basically flat, finished at 13,345. The NASDAQ up 11 points, 1/3%, 3,016 at the bell. The S&P 500 up less than a point, settled at 1433. Weak sales for preschooler toys hurt Hasbro's quarterly earnings. The stock gave back more than 1.67% today. SunTrust Banks also posted earnings that missed expectations. Shares off more than 3%. Morgan Stanley down 0.5% today. General Electric buzzed down 1.5%, continued to slide from last week's disappointing earnings. The biggest U.S. tanker company, Overseas Ship Holding Group, plunged more than 60% today, 60%. The company said it's reviewing bankruptcy options. Well, that explains that, doesn't it? Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.81%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, the Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting on interest rates. On October 23, 2001, Apple unveiled the iPod. It could store 1,000 songs. One of those songs could have been Eat It. Also on Tuesday, Weird Al turns 53. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Well, today may finally be the day we all put Lance Armstrong behind us once and for all. This morning, the International Cycling Union said it's going to strip Armstrong of all 7 of his Tour de France titles and ban him for life. He's lost key sponsorship deals from Nike and Trek, the bicycle company, and Oakley, the sunglasses people. You throw in the loss of income from speaking engagements, and Armstrong's had about $15 million a year. How much more might he have to lose? Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
Now that Lance Armstrong is no longer the 7-time Tour de France winner, will the companies that paid his bonuses and endorsements come after him for that money? Well, that all depends on how those contracts were worded.
Many times what they will do in a contract like that is have what's called a liquidated damages clause.
Rod Smith directs the Center for Sports Law and Policy at Thomas Jefferson Law School. He says that a liquid damage clause is sort of like a prenup. Basically, the two parties agree on a specific amount to be paid in the event of any wrongdoing by the recipient of the money.
And it's possible, right, and perhaps even probable, that those kinds of clauses appear in his endorsement contract.
But, Smith points out, it may not be worth it for those companies to pursue litigation.
Then it's just a question of whether the sponsor wants to continue to keep this in the limelight and try and pursue that or simply move forward.
There's always that question, well, are we shooting ourselves in the foot by calling more and more attention to it?
Brian Goff is a sports economist at Western Kentucky University.
Even among sports economists, they disagree on that.
Goff says it could go one of two ways. Either people could see the doping scandal as proof that the cycling community is serious about cleaning up its act, which could be good for the sport's image, or, on the other hand, Armstrong could ruin cycling's reputation along with his own. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
The internet is changing what it means to go to college. Online learning, as you probably heard, is the new thing. Even some of this country's most prestigious universities have been putting a growing number of their courses online. For nothing, too, for free. Millions of students from all over the world have been piling into the digital classroom. It's an experiment in worldwide teaching, you could say, that's backed by a group of professors who want to revolutionize higher education. And conveniently, there's money to be made, too. Stephen Smith from American Radio Works takes a closer look.
I'm at the headquarters of Udacity, a free online university located in California's Silicon Valley. In the command center, whiteboards are covered with inscrutable equations and color-coded action plans. There are rows of computers staffed by young people sipping energy drinks.
This pod right here is our video editing pod, where very talented video editors and producers take raw footage from our faculty members, edit it into the great content that appears on our site.
David Stavins is the president of Udacity, which calls itself a 21st century university.
Udacity is trying to make great education available to the entire world. Right now, great education is available to a few tens of thousands of people in great institutions in the U.S. and in parts of Europe and Asia and South America, but there are still millions, if not hundreds of millions of people who cannot get access to education.
Statistics is a discipline that makes you understand data
This is the introductory video for the Udacity class Statistics 101, taught by Stanford researcher Sebastian Thrun. He's sitting behind a colorful pile of Lego building blocks. Thrun picks up a few Legos and snaps them together.
Data comes in different shapes and sizes and colors. If you are Google, these might be web pages. Or in finance, these might be stocks and bonds going up.
Udacity classes focus on science and technology. They're aimed at helping students get new jobs or move up to better positions. Udacity co-founder Sebastian Thrun says college is just too expensive for the millions of people who need higher education to find 21st century jobs. And in the modern economy, he says, workers need to constantly update their knowledge and skills while staying on the job.
So what I hope to achieve is that we change the entire educational model to make it more flexible so people can keep learning and keep learning for free as they go through life.
Just down the road from Udacity is its main competitor, Coursera. It has signed up more than 24 colleges and universities to offer many of their classes free on Coursera's website. The schools include prestigious names like Stanford, Princeton, and the University of Pennsylvania. And Coursera offers a wide range of academic subjects.
Welcome to my Coursera course, an introduction to operations management.
This introductory class to world music and culture.
The course is called Think Again, How to Reason and Argue.
With a few exceptions, you don't get actual course credit from Udacity or Coursera classes. But Coursera co-founder Andrew Ng says you do get a certificate of completion.
I think the world is moving towards less formal forms of accreditation, and I think we will increasingly see students take these certificates and use them in their resumes and get better jobs.
In Trondheim, Norway, 24-year-old Ivar Erdal is studying engineering at a local university. He recently took a Stanford computer science class from Coursera.
I really wanted to go to this prestigious American universities after high school, but the tuition costs didn't really give me the opportunity to go. This Coursera model provides me this unique opportunity to also get some of that world-class education, but by free.
Now, if Udacity and Coursera are giving away classes free to millions of students, how can they stay in business? There are at least two ways to make money, says Coursera's Daphne Kohler. Classes should always be free, she says, but maybe not the proof that you successfully completed the course.
So the certification might be something that people pay a modest amount for, and when you multiply it by the numbers of people that we're talking about, can bring in a nice revenue stream.
Coursera and Udacity will also offer a kind of job referral service where each will charge a fee to connect successful students with companies that are hiring. Both Coursera and Udacity are for-profit businesses. Both have won the backing of Silicon Valley venture capitalists like Scott Sandell with New Enterprise Associates.
We look for things that change the world, change the way people work, the way they play. You know, we like to say that we invest in really large markets that don't exist yet.
Together, Udacity and Coursera have already signed up more than a million students. Not bad for a market that didn't exist just 2 years ago. This is Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
Talking politics at the office can be awkward sometimes, but can you be fired for it? Not if you work for the government or if you're unionized or if you have a contract, but some private sector bosses can and do try to tell employees who to vote for, and they tell them about the consequences if they don't oblige. Joseph Little is a professor of law emeritus at the University of Florida. Professor, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Is this legal? Can companies actually fire you if you don't vote the right way? I mean, I'll be honest with you. This kind of floored me when I first read about this.
Well, the answer, I think, is yes. We in this country have a basic employment relationship that is called employment at will. And that means that an employer may fire the employee at will for any time and for any reason with no consequences.
Does this also reflect itself in possible political pressure in the workplace? I mean, employers subtly telling employees for whom they might want to consider casting their ballot?
Or even not so subtly telling them for whom to cast their ballot. Yes, it could. As a matter of fact, I had a man within the last year tell me that he would fire any employee who voted the wrong way.
What's the recourse? I mean, I suppose you could always just try to find another job, but unemployment is almost 8%, right?
Under these circumstances, I think the employee has very little recourse, except perhaps if the employer presses about how to vote, then prevaricate, maybe, yeah. Or forget whom you voted for.
I imagine this is rare, right? I mean, we are talking the rare instance here.
My hunch is that it's not hen's tooth rare, if that's what you mean by rare.
I'm sorry, hen's tooth?
Yeah, you okay. know, rare as hen's teeth. How many hens have you seen with a tooth?
Got it.
But my guess is that there are employments where the employer is a dedicated X. My guess is in those circumstances that employees at will, especially in a relatively small employment, would be very reluctant to show their support for the opposing candidate. So that kind of thing, my guess, is fairly frequent. The actual coming out and making a threat of some kind, my guess is rare. Maybe not hen's tooth rare, but rare.
And now I know what hen's teeth are. Joseph Little is a professor of law emeritus at the University of Florida. We got a hold of him down in Gainesville. Professor, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
All right, and go Gators.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, next time you see your bank teller obsessively taking all the bills in her drawer and sorting them so they're all face up and turned the right way, tell her she doesn't have to do that anymore. Here's the deal. For years, the money counting machines at the Federal Reserve would destroy bills that went into its currency counting machines facing the wrong way. Yes, destroyed. It's not clear exactly why in the journal article that I read this morning. But the good news is new technology now lets the Fed count money, whether it's upside down, backwards, sideways, or what. Me, I still like my wallet to look nice and tidy. Thank you very much. All right, now you know a little something about me, right? Okay, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 2 points, basically flat, finished at 13,345. The NASDAQ up 11, a third percent, 3,016. The S&P 500 up less than a point, settled at 1,433. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Joel Patterson, and Jolie Podokas. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.